is the first to do this for us. Because I was talking to George Durrett, who's the rancher farm manager, and he remembers just shortly after Bob bought the land here that he took Joe, and Joe had met Bob, and Joe was looking for a piece of property in the rural area, and he said, gee, I've got some land for you. And so one January, in a snowstorm, George Durrett had a truckload of lumber and Joe Pierce and dropped them off at the end of Rainbow Ridge so that Joe could build a house. And so that, you were the first one here, Joe, on this new land area. Also, over the years, Joe was a mentor to Bob Monroe. He helped. Bob would always go to the wisest of people and ask questions and look for guidance. And Joe, being right here, obviously lent himself and his wisdom to Bob Monroe. As he has all of us, I consider him a dear friend and confidant. I know, he keeps saying 10 seconds, 10 seconds. But I wanted to read something here, Joe. Well, often when I introduce him, we only have an hour or two, and so it's fitting. But today we have, well, we have a day and a half. So I want to read some about Joe's history. He was a faculty member on child development at the Jung Institute in Switzerland. Spoke of the new paradigm of human development at the 7th Annual Transpersonal Psychology Conference in India. Oxford University invited Joe to present the impact of obstetrical practices that they were having on child development. The Canadian government sponsored a workshop with Native Americans on the prevention of violence and substance abuse. Sony Corporation sponsored a 17-day lecture series on the future of education in Japan. He addressed Hawaii's Crime Prevention Commission and that on the current causes of crime and violence. The state of Louisiana sponsored an address on the crisis facing the American family. Three different departments at Harvard and the University of California invited Joe to address two special legislative planning sessions on the challenges facing children and families. And Columbia University asked him to give a special address on education in the 21st century. So I can go on and on, but I see that he's getting impatient. Joe, it's with gratitude and deep respect that I welcome you and introduce you.
Isn't she sweet?
I love you.
Thank you, I love you too. Well, why hash over one's past? Doesn't do a nickel's worth of good. I still make all the same errors I ever did. The reason for this might become apparent as we go along. I want to start off with a comment by David Elkind the other day. He's one of our great developmentalists. And he was giving a public address, and he said, we have learned more about the development of the human mind from conception on than any society or culture has ever known before about the development of our children. And he followed that up by saying, and point for point in all of this new research and discovery we've made, point for point, we in the United States do the exact opposite. In every case. So research comes up and says, here's something incredible about the human mind right from the beginning. We read it and do the opposite. This is kind of strange, but that's the way it goes. I'm going to be talking about development, but indirectly. I want to get into it from a different angle today than I've ever tried before. So be with me, because I'm liable to get myself out in wild blue yonder and not be able to get back. But I want to talk about research that took place over a number of years ago started checking out the magnetic fields that the Earth produces. Here's an artist's conception of them. It doesn't make any difference whether it's upside down or not. The geographic South Pole and geographic North Pole and so on and so forth, and these great magnetic fields that come out from each of the poles. They surround the Earth, and then they go on out until finally they're merging with, and this is the actual case, with the magnetic fields of the sun and so on and so forth. Well, there were two scientists, and they set up two sensing stations about 1,000 miles apart to record on a 24-hour day basis, record the activity of the Earth's electromagnetic fields that it's producing and coming out through each of the poles. Got it, what they wanted to do? And then, periodically, they brought their two recordings together and compared them. It's rather like getting an electrocardiogram. Do you ever have one made? And they put all these different things all over your body. And they find that they all say pretty much the same thing, don't they? Your body is one responsive unit. Well, the same thing with the Earth. They found in comparing these two records made 1,000 miles apart that they were recording the same thing. So it seemed pretty safe to go by what was happening. The next thing that these guys found was before every major catastrophe of any sort on Earth, before every earthquake, the blow up of Mount St. Helena, wasn't it? Back a number of years, what? St. Helen. Yeah, a number of years ago. And the great tsunami of 2004, remember that one? Big stuff. Before each of those experiences and during them, these electromagnetic fields the Earth was producing changed profoundly in a very clearly detectable way before every one of these disturbances on Earth. Well, of course, this makes sense. You start looking at the great tectonic plates that underlie the continents and the fact that they're pretty much always in shifting and moving. If something really big is up, what happens? The Earth kind of telegraphs her punch and sends out an electromagnetic signal through its electromagnetic process, the poles and their great fields coming out, saying, hey, something is up. Some kind of ruction's up. This is why we found that dogs and various animals will start barking and raising cane hours and hours before an actual earthquake hits. Why? Well, they're picking up something that we're not sensitive to that's going on in the Earth. Now, all of this sounded fine, except that they noticed that the Earth was signaling ahead of time. In many cases, the blow-up of St. Helena, they were picking up signals from this quite a bit ahead of time, well in advance of the thing itself. Same thing with the tsunami of 2004, etc., etc. All this could be expected on a physical level, but the one thing no one could have prepared them for and that sent them into a real tizzy was the identical same ructions in the electromagnetic fields that surround the Earth were made in advance of 9/11. And they checked this every way come Sunday. Nope. Same pattern exactly of warning before 9/11. How in the world could this be? This gets spooky. And that's what we're going to be talking about. See, I think. But Paul MacLean said the brain operates entirely by resonance. What does he mean by resonance? I find that the most mysterious word in the world. Resonance. Well, that's whatever it is that when I come across certain people, I think, oh boy, give me a hug. And others, you know, I'm just not resonant with. So it has to do with emotions. It has to do with electromagnetic energies, and I don't like the term, I would call them forces, which is more realistic. It has to do with a lot of that sort of thing, but the brain puts together its picture through resonance. Bob Monroe, talk about an interesting character. He spoke one time of on this highway out of the body. You remember that, what did he call it?
Interstate.
What?
Interstate.
The interstate. And remember he said, well, these people have left their bodies behind and they're just this, whatever it is that is remaining, going down the interstate highway. He said, you'll see them pulling off these different exits. What pulls them off these different exits? Resonance. Whatever they're most resonant with will attract them and they'll peel off here and there. Bob, of course, had set himself up in a pretty different category, and I think he was, and he had a perfect right to brag about it. He said, but there are those of us who are not resonant with any of this, really, but only in exploration. We just keep going. And so he didn't find any resonance here with the Christians peeling off here and the Muslims peeling off here and these and that and the other. None of that attracted Bob. He had no resonance with that. He had resonance only with exploration. And he didn't let you forget that in case you got hung up on the resonance along the way. So the business of this field, which the heart produces, this frequency realm, is from which the brain puts together its whole picture of our experience in the body of the world. But it's far more than that. And for this, I'm gonna drop back to the early, no, the mid-70s. I met an Indian guru. I had great contempt for gurus at that time. I had an old colleague at the University of California, professor of philosophy, and we spoke with great contempt in the mid-70s of the guru of the month club. Who's the guru of the month? You know, everybody's throwing flower petals in their path and so forth, a different one every month. And I made fun of all this too until my seminar director, I had to hire a seminar director for the Magical Child Seminars because I had such an overload of requests to come and give talks on this, I couldn't get the book written. I was trying to write the book, The Magical Child, and I was getting most of my information from audiences. I was too lazy to go into a library, so I just gave talks on it, and from my audiences would come two responses, saying I was crazy to mention such and such. Look up the research of so and so and you'll find that you can't make that statement. Boy, I was scratching it all down. And then some statement I would make and throw it out there on the blackboard, and someone would say, yes, that's just what so and so and so and I put those names down. And so I had both a constant corrective and a marvelous source of information. So I didn't have to fool around with research. People would say to me, how do you have time to do all that research? All I was doing is going around and yakking, and it all came in. But at any rate, now what was that apropos of? My seminar director had been one of Werner Erhard's est main forces, managing all this stuff for Werner Erhard. She came to a Magical Child seminar. She quit her job with Werner and she said, I'm going to take over this, whether you can pay me or not. We've got to get this message out. She was quite enthusiastic about it all. But and she started, we were finally booked up a whole year ahead. And then she came back one day. She lived up in Oakland. I was down in about 100 miles south, and she came back and said she had just met this incredible guru from India and wanted me to meet him. She later reported that I got so disgusted with her, she was afraid to mention it again because she was sure I'd fire her from her job. A guru. Well, as things went on right over here in my little hand-built cabin, and by the way, it wasn't at the end of Rainbow Ridge. There was no Rainbow Ridge. When I built over there, there was no road. And this whole property, we had to come in through the Smith Brothers farm over here. And there were no power lines, no telephone lines. That's why I chose that little 5-acre plot. And I got it when Hunter Moyer owned the property, before Bob bought it from Hunter Moyer. And so that little 5-acre plot had an interesting history. I don't know what that was all about, but the sitting right there in that little house of mine, we didn't have electricity, and had only these oil lamps, Aladdin lamps, they call them. They give about a 40-watt glow, wonderful things. And I'd just gotten in through the mail, and I had no mailing address. Only my publisher had my mailing address, so they could send me any checks that might come along. But I wouldn't have to bother with ordinary mail. Well, I didn't get much of either one, as it turns out. But someone had sent me a copy of a book by this Muktananda. And I wrinkled up my nose when my seminar director talked about him several years before. Didn't have anything to do with it. And here, about 3 years later, happily lost to the world over here on what would be Rainbow Ridge, and I did nothing but meditate. I meditated and gardened and waited for a royalty check to keep the police away. And I'd had really 3 years of most incredible meditation experiences. I picked up this meditation practice from a thing going on in the West Coast. And when I quit the world and swore I would never again pay a penny of tax money in my life, and settled down there to nothing but meditating and gardening and hoping a check would come from the publisher in time to keep me out of jail, my family and myself. And here came a book called Play of Consciousness. And working on the chapter Play in my book Magical Child, on the top of this little mountain in the Santa Cruz Mountains, overlooking Silicon Valley, a little place the Jesuits had given me to finish my book, Magical Child, in. I'd had this incredible experience on the issue of play, and it was such an enormous experience that I finished up Magical Child right quick, took my advance money from E.P. Dutton, gave him the manuscript of Magical Child, and disappeared. And left no forwarding address to anyone, and to my seminar director, Nancy Brown. I went up and I'd given her full power of attorney over the title, Magical Child. She could have all the seminar stuff and all of our equipment and files and so on and so forth. I was leaving, and I had no forwarding address. And it was a great blow to Nancy. She tried to make it work, but she couldn't. And it had to do with this. There were experiments by wiring people up for electroencephalographs, brain waves, and electrocardiograms, heart waves, and projecting these on a screen and following what's going on in that person's mind and heart at any time. And they find that the heart produces a magnetic, electromagnetic power 60 times greater in amplitude than the brain. We've been making all of our fuss over brain waves for a long, long time. They're minuscule compared to great energy force that we find coming out of the heart. And so the issue with these people all wired up at HeartMath, Carl Prebram, and I believe it's Braden, came up with an experiment about galvanic skin response. It's been a great mystery and riddle, because actually there's no way that the brain can send a signal that will move the muscles of the body as they can be moved. And it's been a great riddle. Only recently, a marvelous biologist at the University of London, Mei-Wan Ho, how do you like that name? Chinese, Irish, let's say. Mei-Wan Ho has been doing a lot of in-depth research on the coherence of the body's 78 trillion cells. And the fact that when you're in real coherence with yourself, kind of love and charity with your neighbor, that coherence throughout all 78 trillion cells is perfect. So that you're producing from the body one coherent energy field. Is that making any sense? And that Mei-Wan Ho said the uncanny coherence of this human body, and we know that that coherence is controlled and maintained by the heart. The heart is the one that maintains the coherence of all 78 trillion cells. The other thing that has been found, and I'll just skip around with a few of these, that this first field which saturates the body to maintain the coherence of that body must be coherent in order for you to open to fully this second field, which is your relationships. That's the relational brain, the emotional relational field that surrounds you. And for that to be coherent, the first field must be coherent. And if the first field of the body itself is coherent, that opens you to a full access to the second field around you, which is emotional, a purely emotional field. Emotion being the character or quality of relationships that you're experiencing. Now, when the heart brings all this into a single coherency, these two open up to the third realm. And there we get into some interesting things, because they find that this third realm doesn't seem to stop. It just keeps going. Where does it go? Well, we have to trace that out for a little bit, and we'll come across some interesting things. And that is, of course, that third field begins to mesh or fuse, cohere, come into balance with these electromagnetic fields that surround the Earth. Makes sense, doesn't it? They're the larger electromagnetic field in which we live and have our breathing, and the greater our own internal coherence, the more we're open to the coherence of the whole system and contribute to it. Now, maybe we need, let me see if I can get us a little picture here of coherent and incoherent waveforms. Well, for instance, if your brain waves and your heart rate variability and respiration, muscular responses and so on, physical, all are coherent, you'll get a single wave coherency in the whole body system itself. And at that point, everything is different. And they speak of the frequency spectrum which is found within any single instance heartbeat. This is the frequency spectrum that really is an overlap of two different images entirely, but this is a frequency spectrum of one instant of the heartbeat. This isn't a timeline starting here and ending up here. And these spikes going up show the amplitude that this single instant pulsation of the heart has all sorts of different amplitudes. And as you learned in high school physics, probably, I didn't, but some people did, that the slower the frequency, the higher the amplitude. The faster the frequency, the lower the amplitude. And so this covers the frequencies from zero all the way up to 40-something hertz. Hertz being the H-E-R-T-Z, the frequency level at which this single field is operating. And out of it come all of these different levels of amplitude. Now, what about any single level of amplitude right here is really the equivalent of a different station on your radio. What you do when you twirl your dial, you're going from one amplitude to another, in effect. This station broadcasts at so many amplitudes, this one at so much other, and your dial can pick up, and you find that each of those amplitudes carries what? A huge amount of information. So that the sum total of it is incalculable, because any one of them could carry all the information practically you needed to go on. Let's get back for a minute to thinking about Carl Pribram, again, that brilliant neuroscientist. By the way, the state of Virginia gave Carl, when he retired from Stanford as professor emeritus, they gave him their chair of distinguished scholarship, set him up in a beautiful brain laboratory at the University of Radford, and all these people from all over the world were coming to Radford to be with Carl in his research at Radford University. Isn't that interesting? A lot of people are not aware of that. I've forgotten what that was all about. Oh, yeah. Carl had proposed back in the 1970s that the brain gets all of its information on which it acts to put together our experience of the world out there from this body within here. That the brain gets this information from a frequency realm which is not in time-space. Okay, a frequency realm which is not in time-space. Now, when heart math turns out pictures like this and say, well, if we look at the frequency spectrum of a single instant heartbeat and we find that this frequency realm has all these different modulations in it, all these different frequencies, we're looking at the source from which the brain gets all of its information to put together our experience of body in the body of the world. Another great neuroscientist was Paul MacLean. He and Carl Pribram didn't get along well. Professional jealousy, I think. Or incoherent. Let me get back to that. The next thing we find in this is that the fields of the earth forming these great embracing fields from each of the poles mesh with the fields of the heart if the heart is coherent. The fields of the earth have always been coherent until very recently, but something has happened. Here's a picture that NASA took from a satellite, an electromagnetic image of the earth itself. And here's what that satellite image of the earth looked like. And here we find exactly the same thing. The fields coming out, the color coding showing at a different amplitude from each of the poles, swirling out around, forming this great torus form, which embraces the whole planet. And we'll talk about what a torus form is in just a minute. But if you see these great arcs coming out, these are going to go all the way out and fuse with the solar system's own fields that it sends out. And here, many of these arcs or torus forms that only come partially and back in and out on a wider and wider level. Now, we'll talk about the rest of this in a minute when we get to it. Let's just stick to that much for the time being. That these fields from the earth, for one thing, are really, they match what we find in the fields coming from the heart. The only thing is, they're bigger, to say the least. Now, the next thing was the discovery that these forms are found coming out of the sun. The very first picture we had of this was, I don't have a color coding of it, but you'll see exactly the same thing. These swirls of energy, here they call them plasma. They're like huge, incredible rivers of pure electromagnetic power coming out of the sun, curling around and back in on wider and wider levels, and then here are these that go out to embrace the entire solar system. And that was nothing like the one we had given us by NASA on January 14th, 2004, I think, from Earth, from electromagnetic images taken from Earth of the sun. And look at it. This is, when I saw this, I bowed and genuflected toward Rome and whatever. This was, I took off my shoes. We were on sacred territory. Look at these fields coming out of the sun. They're perfectly coherent, every one of them. There's nothing incoherent in all. It looks like a great scramble. No, look carefully. Each one is a perfectly coherent, curving out, back in, wider and wider levels. And here again, the color coding showing a different frequency coming from this side than from this side of the sun itself, and moving out and embracing the whole solar system. So what do we find? We find the very same pattern that is emerging from our heart and holding our whole body within its embrace, simply repeated over and over on ever. We say larger forms. But once you get into this, that kind of scalar measurement is pointless. There's no bigger and smaller. There is simply, what are you going to do with this kind of a relationship? And of course, we find that underlying this is the whole creative process. This is how things are. And the fact that our fields mesh and merge with the fields of the earth, and they in turn mesh and merge with the fields of the sun, to the extent that we are within our own life, within our own body and mind, coherent, we are automatically what? What? We're automatically simply part of that whole structure. We contain it all within us, and we participate with it in the same way. Now that brings me up to the point where we need to discuss the actual shapes that this field coming out of the heart forms. That shape is what is called a torus. Let's just glance at this computer simulation of a torus and get into what we mean. You notice that it comes out, around, and back in. And then on wider and wider and wider levels. And the same thing, of course, with the Earth. Now, what forms is a figure called a torus. And I'm going to borrow here from David Bohm, the great physicist, his term, holonomic. The first thing we find about the torus coming out of our heart is it's holonomic. Since it's holonomic, it would be impossible to take a piece of it out. But if you could, you would find that the tiniest part of this holonomic measurement contains the information of the totality. The closest thing we have is holographic photography. You've probably heard of holographic photography. And it's an exciting thing when you first see it. They used to make photographs on a glass plate. You put that emulsion, what is it, silver nitrate or something like that, emulsion on a on a plate of glass to make pictures back in the, what would they call them, daguerreotype? Yeah, thank you. I won't repeat it. In fact, in my grandmother's attic, I found a whole box of these plates, these glass plates. It was one of my favorite uncle's pastimes, was making these, and that's all they had. Just before celluloid was invented and used for film. Now, the thing about holographic filming is the use of this. Well, no need to go into the mechanics of it since I don't understand them. But it's simply the different positioning of two sources of light coming into the film. Any part of it contains the image of the whole. And you can take a holographic photograph on a plate and break the plate into all these different fragments. Any tiny fragment contains the image of the totality. Now, the smaller the fragment, the more difficult it is to bring it into clarity. But it can always be done with the appropriate work on it, machinery, and so forth and so on. Do you understand what I'm saying about that? The holographic plate contains the image. Break it into all the pieces you can think of, each fragment contains the image. But the smaller the fragment, the fuzzier the image. And you have to use the same process that you made in the beginning to bring the clarity out of that little image. Got that? Now, therein also lies the whole secret of what things are about with us. It's a beautiful example, holonomic. That's the torus. The second thing about the torus that the heart produces, it seems to be almost, once set into motion, almost self-generative. And they call it the most stable energy form that you can have. Stable meaning once set into motion of that torus form, it tends to self-replicate. With the holonomic expression of this. And where does it begin? I mean, where does all this stuff begin? They were going to have to get into Charles Darwin. In fact, I have a tendency to rush into it because I think it's such exciting stuff. But we're going to have to look into the very, very first appearance of the heart and the brain, because they make their very first appearance as a unit, as a paired twin effect of heart and brain, as a single self-system that forms in the neural tube, one of the very earliest formations in your mother's womb after conception takes place. Conception takes place, and immediately one of the very earliest things is this little grouping of cells forms called the neural tube. They call it the neural tube because the neural tube gives rise to all the neurons that are going to be located up here in the skull and form a brain. At the same time, the neural tube as itself morphs through very clearly, easy distinguishable stages into the heart. So the neural tube is giving rise to the brain up here in our head at the very time it's morphing into the shape of the heart itself. And our sense of self forms immediately with that neural tube. Self is as much a genetic part of our system as color of hair or eyes, or the fact we have two arms and legs ordinarily, and so on. So it's as much a part of the genetic system as anything else, our sense of self, which sets us apart, so far as we can tell, from the rest of the animal kingdom. The rest of the animal kingdom has remarkable consciousness, tremendous ability to respond instantly to signals from the heart, which we lose as mind-brain systems, but not animals. They retain that, but no sense of self in our sense of self. That's what that major difference sets us apart from the rest of the animal kingdom. But it's through that apartness that we're set that gives us, I'll get into later, because it opens up just huge things for us that are closed to the animals, and why the evolutionary process brought us about out of that animal heritage with this new capacity, which is found in the sense of self, which is first expressed in the neural tube. Now, some of you probably know really all about this and can correct me on all my errors on it, but I've given a rough summary of it, of really how this thing works. And we end up with a self orienting toward mind or brain here, and the self which remains located in the heart. And so we have the heart as self and the brain as self, and their interaction doing what? Giving rise to each other. Now that, and this, we'll take a break in just a second, but that gets us into one final little part right here. Back in the 80s, a physicist from Indiana University, a guy by the name of Douglas Hofstadter. And some of you might be familiar with Hofstadter's remarkable work. It's now standard university text practically all over the world. And I guess I spent a couple of years trying to read that blasted thing. For some reason or other, he writes in a beautifully lucid fashion and makes everything very clear. But to follow his overall logic, I found a tremendous challenge until I realized that what Hofstadter was saying in this great book of his called Gödel, Escher and Bach. He was dealing with the strange loops that science constantly runs across, the strange loop effect in science that science itself can't account for and tries to pretend doesn't exist. And this physicist turned out this huge, very, really complicated book to show that there was a strange loop between field and product of the field, between cause and effect. In my first book, Cracking the Cosmic Egg, I tried to explain this phenomena, arising primarily from my own experience. I am a great believer in phenomenology. The only thing I really ever believe is what I have experienced. All the abstract nonsense I've been told about since I was born that I'm supposed to believe in, but haven't been able to deal with, that's abstraction. But my own concrete phenomena, which I've lived through, that I know. And what he was getting around to in my book, Crack, following my belief, is John Archibald Wheeler, the great physicist. Now, I'd stand to be corrected on that one, really. But he had come out with a comment looking at what's happening with astronomy and our knowledge of the stars and the cosmos and everything, down to the tiniest little atom and everything. John Archibald Wheeler looked at all this and he says, it's just too much. He said, it seems that the human mind is a mirror of this whole universe. And boy, did I light on this when I finally came across that. I said, yes, the human mind is a mirror of a universe that mirrors the human mind. If you leave that part out of it, you're licked. No, the human mind mirrors a universe which mirrors the human mind. There are no one-way streets in creation or evolution. No one-way streets. And that was what this whole book, Gödel, Escher, and Bach, a very famous book, I'm sure Pulitzer and all the rest of it, went with it. And still, in fact, today, more in use in universities than ever before. And what he used these, Gödel, the famous mathematician who showed that no mathematical proof could ever be completely sufficient, and Escher, how many of you have seen these strange pictures by Escher? I love them. And here you're looking at it and you see this waterfall. The only thing is you look at it again, the waterfall is going upside down. I mean, the stairway. Here are these people going down the stairway, but they're also at the same time ascending a stairway. How many of you are familiar with those? Escher turned out a whole batch of these, and he was, according to Hofstadter, Escher was trying to break through to us a tremendous secret that there are no one-way streets. We enter into the creation of every single phenomena we ever experience. We can't, the popular New Age thing of, oh, we each create our own reality. That's BS. We don't create our own reality, but we enter into that creation as an equal part of it. We enter into it.
It's our pleasure today to welcome you to our interview with Joseph Chilton Pierce. We had the opportunity to interview Joe at the Monroe Institute in Fayetteville, Virginia in October of 2011. And it was such a thrill for me because he's been a hero of mine for years in regard to the work that I've done with children and families throughout the years. He is an author, he is a child development specialist, and he is an incredible soul. So we welcome you to share in the wisdom that this man has and he is willing to share with us right now. His latest books, he's written The Crack in the Cosmic Egg, The Magical Child, The Magical Child and the Magical Parent, The Biology of Transcendence, Spiritual Initiation and the Breakthrough of Consciousness, and recently, The Death of Religion and the Rebirth of Spirit, A Return to the Intelligence of the Heart. I hope that you will enjoy him as much as we enjoyed the time that we got to spend with him. Welcome.
But the idea I teach, I actually did teach for a while. I had several years in the academic world, and I felt that, I didn't teach anything. And it was true. But I write books. If people get something out of it, that's fine. But I don't consider myself teaching. I write about what I'm interested in and my own experience. I don't write about anything that I have not personally experienced.
Well, that's saying a lot because you've personally experienced quite a lot in your
life. I have, and I think I'm real fortunate in that. And I think other people probably experience a great deal more than they talk about. Right. I just happen to talk about my experiences.
Well, I think that it's really important because the things that you share in your books are the things that make people understand about not only themselves, but about other people as well.
Yes. I really would like to live long enough to do one more little book, and that's on the spiritual experience of very early life. And I think that the average child, say up until age 3 or 4, has a great many more spiritual experiences than are recognized, or if they have them, than are allowed.
Exactly.
We think of Burton Jones' marvelous work, The First 3 Years, and he said that he and his staff at Harvard had looked at the American child population to see about what percentage of them could be considered brilliant and happy. They came to the conclusion that it was maybe 3% of the American child population.
Really?
Oh, what happens? But the most outstanding feature of these brilliant, happy children was they spent an inordinate amount of their time in blank, open-eyed staring, doing nothing at all. And I thought of what would happen today if a child spent a great deal of time in open-eyed staring, doing nothing at all. Why, we would have every psychiatrist and therapist and social worker and everything else breathing down both the child's neck and the parents. Don't just stand there, do something. Mm-hmm. But we all heard that when we were children. And so that just is a little clue here of one of the many aspects of the human mind that gets shut down and cut off, not fed by feedback, social feedback, and atrophy, kind of wither away. And I think that's what happens with our so-called spiritual experience. Without any outlet for it or without any recognition of it, we tend to let those things wither away, I believe. To a great extent. So, as I say, I've never written about anything I have not experienced. And I write about my experience. My own experience is the kernel of what I write. Then I gather all sorts of stuff that would bolster my case in any way. And in this last book, for instance, I start off with some really, I think, just good observations, and then following it with a lot of what we think of as hardcore scientific backup. But scientific backup is not really what I'm after at all. It's just that I find if I can use something that passes the notion of science says, people will listen to it. But that's because we have made a religion of science.
Yes.
I'm talking about material, mechanical science. We've made a religion of it, which is, of course, rapidly destroying both ourselves and our planet. But I found very early on, if you want to be heard at all, you've got to have a certain amount of the scientific rubrics under which you're writing. Well, I'll stop at that point.
Oh, don't stop at that point at all. This is a huge problem you're uncovering, that science is the predominant thing, and it's all about material.